You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 1st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday. Will it be the last Casual Friday before the birth of my new child? Ever? I don't know. It's possible we could squeeze one more Casual Friday in. Conceivable, too. But who knows? And on the program today to celebrate that really non-celebratory event, this being potentially the last Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter! And giving us movie recommendations, or a movie recommendation. I want to say Academy Award winner, but he was actually not an Academy Award winner, but he was in a movie that won the Academy Award. Richard Kind, hot off his performance in Argo.
Academy Award winner associate.
Academy Award winner once or twice removed. On the program today, the president just giving a press conference on the day that the sequester begins to roll out. We will talk to Cliff Schechter about that and more in just a moment. Also on the program today, taxpayer-funded research will be free now. Basically, one of Aaron Swartz's wishes and things that he had advocated for, yet simultaneously reports that, based on a Freedom of Information request, that the Secret Service is still investigating him weeks after his death. Bradley Manning spoke yesterday in his plea hearing. We will give you some highlights of what he said during that hearing. And as per usual, the knives are still out for our social insurance programs. And we will talk about that with Cliff and more in just a moment. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great Cliff Schechter.
Last night,
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. And on the phone, of course, the great Cliff Schechter. But before we get to Cliff Schechter, the great Cliff Schechter theme song provided by Jimmy Reefer Cake. Please begin, Jimmy.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. If you want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
There's nothing better than hearing Matt crack open a Coca-Cola to the Cliff Schechter theme song, which I should add, later in the program, we have a special treat for Jermo, one of our favorite callers. He's got his own theme song now. Doesn't have the backup vocals, which I realize. But so stay tuned, Jermo, if you're out there listening. You're going to want to crank it up for later in the program. Cliff, welcome.
How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
You're hanging?
Sure.
Sure, why not, right?
Yeah.
Getting excited to be a daddy yet again.
Yeah, indeed. Are you there? Did we just lose you?
Did you say, can you not hear me?
No, we can hear you. You're breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure why. That's probably on our end, but I'm sure.
Okay, I am here as loud as always, so hopefully you'll be able to hear that.
Great.
And transmit into form others can understand.
Oh, you know what? We may have to call you right back because your phone seems to be breaking up a little bit. Are you on a cordless?
I am. I haven't had this problem before. Call me back, and we'll work
this out.
All right.
We'll, folks, give us 1 second.
I could play Cliff's theme song on repeat.
I don't know if we want to do that.
This mailbox is unable to accept voicemail messages.
Oh, well, we got a little insight into Cliff. He's not answering his... They're not doing the...
Hello?
Hello, Cliff. You got to clean out your voicemail box, incidentally.
I do?
Yeah, apparently it's not taking voicemail.
Wow, that's obnoxious of it.
All right, well, now, yeah.
I wonder if anybody called me and had, like, $1 million from a Nigerian bank that I could have gotten I'd only answered it.
That we actually have a clip from Pat Robertson to that effect later in the program. But so
really, does the Nigerian bank also help people scare demons out of their clothing?
Apparently,
you know what I'm scared of. If you want to know the truth,
yeah,
sort of along the lines of what Pat Robertson said, that if I go buy my clothing at Goodwill, Gene Sperling might be in them. Yelling at me.
Yes, well, let's,
so that scares me.
There was a lot of news surrounding the sequester this week, and we've certainly spoken about the sequester ad nauseum, but we will talk about that in a moment. But let's start with Bob Woodward, because it would certainly appear that we don't have Bob Woodward to kick around much longer. His career, I think, to a certain extent, has come full circle. His last book on the machinations of President Obama's, debt ceiling deals. I guess his book came out about 3 or 4 months ago. I don't know. It sort of landed with a year ago? Six months ago, I think. It landed with a very soft, quiet thud. And... I think this has been grating on Bob Woodward, and this is his last hurrah. But he started off the week by criticizing President Obama for being so curtailed by this just the piece of paper, this document, this agreement, which other people refer to as law, and Congress's ability to appropriate. He then went on to claim that he was not quite threatened, but certainly trembled by the notion that a Obama administration official would say that he would regret staking out this claim, but also surrounded by all sorts of words of deference. And he responded with his own words of deference, showing that he wasn't trembling at the time. And then he rounded it out with an appearance on Hannity last night, that was, I guess this is basically the going to Hannity's last refuge, right? As your career wanes. I mean, I hope to be there within a couple of years.
It's amazing it's taken this long to really sort of for people to realize that this guy is basically a fraud. And I don't use that word lightly. Over the years, it's been proven a lot of things that he said about his supposed sources, Deep Throat, the guy was a heavy smoker, he really wasn't, that there were all sorts of dishonesty, all sorts of lies he told to try to protect his source. He said at one point on the record he wasn't a member of the intelligence community, unless you don't consider the FBI that was COINTELPRO-ing people back then part of the intelligence community. I don't know how you can look at that as anything other than a lie. And he can try to claim he's protecting his source, but then these other inconsistencies come up. I'm not convinced at this point that the majority of what he said, not majority, I should say, but many things he said in his initial reporting on Watergate were sourced the way he claims they were. Because again and again, since that unbelievable piece of trash of a book, Bush at War, trying to take this guy that literally had trouble tying his shoes without drooling and turning him into some sort of an Attila the Hun type character standing up and beating his own chest as a warrior, as if that was a good image of our president anyhow. I mean, this guy's like a village courtier. He just sits there and writes whatever the people in the White House tell him to say. I've lost faith a long time ago that this guy was ever about anything other than himself. He did what so many other people do. He took a product, what went on during Watergate, and he marketed it well, and he turned himself into this type of reporter everybody wanted to be. And the truth is, when you dig below that surface, as is often the case in the Beltway, you find that he really isn't that guy. His own, editor, his own, Ben Bradley, or publisher, I guess, came out and said that he, did all those meetings happen in the garage, and the singles and the potted plant. Who knows? Even people at the Washington Post think that he might have, just for the sexiness of this, so you get a movie out of it, might have made things up. Well, I think that kind of tells you everything you need to know about this guy. So
when you juxtapose the way that he reported on, if we just look at this exchange with Gene Sperling and as a microcosm of the way or as an analogy for the way that he reports, had the White House not released that email, it would have come out as if he was there were sinister forces that were going to cause him to regret things and this and that. And yes, it may be the case that Gene Sperling, and he's sort of renowned for being an a-hole and lambasting people. But,
Rahm Emanuel isn't. Karl Rove wasn't. And, these guys all have a-holes working for them that do this kind of stuff. There's nothing out of the ordinary in what Gene Sperling did. This is a guy that supposedly was doing what? Light signals, meeting in garages, and things like that, potentially risking his life when you're talking about the Nixon administration and what they were willing to do. But he's scared of Gene Sperling and all his economic credentials, calling him and what? Yelling at him for his lack of understanding of microeconomic principles? What's the threat here? I just think after you read, you see his account.
Right.
And you see that email. After you start looking further and reading his accounts over the years, which change of who Deep Throat was and stuff and things that happened, I don't trust anything this guy says anymore. And I'm not convinced that a lot of it was, obviously we got to the bottom of what Nixon was doing, and yes, but I'm not sure along the way everything he was saying was true. And just because the end result was a good one, and it was a good one because Nixon was a criminal, it doesn't mean in the end that this guy is a saint, and mean that this guy was reporting honestly about everything and sourcing things properly. And you look at that email and you look at other things that have come out about him in recent years and that unbelievable hagiography, Bush at War, how can you trust anything this guy says anymore? Anything for that matter.
And the irony of it all, though, in my mind, is that the one sort of genuinely interesting piece of reporting, at the very least, it's obviously something that we've known, but I don't know if there was. I think there is actually a piece of reporting that came out when the White House released this email from Gene Sperling saying that the idea of entitlement cuts, essentially reform, Tax loopholes was built into the DNA of the sequester. So, which takes us to the next point, which is that the whole idea of the sequester, and whether it was born in White House offices or not, it really is sort of irrelevant, the way that these things get born up. But what's more important is how the White House perceived this. And they saw it as a mechanism to force the Republicans to come to the table and strike a deal to cut entitlements in return for some type of tax reform. And
And if you think about it, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because then nobody wants to be the bad guy on the entitlement cuts. But then you say, well, we had to because of the sequester.
Yes.
Right? So even Obama could say, we didn't want to do that. We had to. But obviously now that we know it was built into the DNA, we know that that is the truth. And, you know, it's like, yeah, it's evidence, but didn't we all know that?
Well, we did know that, but it also shows two things. One, it shows that the sequester was not sort of a desperation play. It was actually, it had as its agenda to get to that grand bargain. Now, we may have known that, but I think this is it's quite clear that that was the game plan for this sequester. It was not to avert a debt ceiling crisis. It was a mechanism to get to a grand bargain. Now, what it also shows, in my estimation, is that the White House has been playing this completely wrong. I know this is all stuff that we have talked about again, but it also, as much as this episode sort of impeaches, not to use a pun.
Be careful to use that word.
I don't want to have been accused of in any way threatening Bob Woodward.
Steve Stockman, call online too.
But it impeaches Woodward's credibility, and it also impeaches the notion that the Obama administration has just been having to do what they can do to deal with Republican obstructionism, but there was a proactive agenda here to get to this grand bargain. And the point of that is, if that is your end game, it's going to change the way that you have reacted to the Republicans all along. In other words, we know as a given there has been intense Republican obstruction. And if your agenda is to get to a grand bargain, you're going to deal with that obstruction in a different way than you would have if you were not interested in those entitlement cuts as part of your agenda. And in addition to that, it also shows that not only do people like you and I, and I think I would argue 80% of the American public, are at odds with the Obama agenda, but also they're also strategically inept, because they couldn't even get there because of their assessment of where Republicans would go. So they both had an agenda that I find problematic. But even in the context, if we stipulate that's their agenda, their approach to this, they fundamentally misread what was the incentive structure for Republicans. And so now we are left with a sequester. There is a concern that we're going to get to the continuing resolution, which is essentially reauthorizing a budget where these sequester cuts may end up as the baseline, or alternatively, the Obama administration, there's every reason to believe, particularly after his press conference today, that they're going to still pursue by calling, saying we're willing to cut entitlements, still pursue that grand bargain, which is still going to be problematic because they clearly don't understand at this point that the only thing the Republicans don't want is more taxes. And that's it, period. They don't care about these other things. Everything else is subsidiary.
Yes. to everything you just said. This whole thing, basically, I feel like we're living through the Aaron Sorkin presidency. Mm. Like that's what this is. Essentially, this is not to take away and say that President Obama doesn't have emotions and feeling at times. I mean, I think when he spoke out about the kids murdered in Newtown, you could see it hit him emotionally. And there have been other times. But overall, it just seems like that the what happens to individuals on an individual level, which is amazing to me as a former community organizer, right, who would understand, you'd think, very well what goes on above, how that affects people, everyday people in their daily lives. But this seems to be the opposite of that. This is sort of the big idea presidency, solving the big problems. You know, he seems more interested almost in his legacy than the last couple of guys, which is amazing to me.
Right.
And so, even when they're, you know, as I pointed out before, sometimes that's a good thing because, for example, on guns, we're all in agreement that, you know, all of us except for the few insane people out there, that this is a public health crisis that needs to be solved. So he may care about it individually, but he also sees himself in 20 years as being the guy who solved a big chunk of that crisis. The problem is he sees that with other things too. With health care, it was getting a big bill as opposed to necessarily maybe fighting for the right bill. And I still would say on balance, the health care bill is very much a net plus for a number of its provisions, but obviously missing a public option and other things. To me, it was about passing the big health care legislation and have that be your legacy. And it seems that that's the same thing driving this stuff because, you know, Digby wrote something, I think it was yesterday, you know, like that, you know, which sort of laid it out, that these guys just seem to be obsessed with finding a way to cut benefits. It's just amazing. It's almost like they're just plotting out how can we force ourselves to do it? How can we find a way around our party's base? And frankly, most people beyond our party's base, like 80% of people out there, and do this. And so it's like they keep trying to back themselves into situations where like, oh, darn, we have to cut entitlements because he wants to be the guy to say, I solved the entitlement problem in 20 years, of which there is none. But that's the problem. This is like government by Aaron Sorkin.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just frustrating as hell.
This is also, I mean, you know, again, there's two parts to this. There is the agenda that we disagree with, but it's also the implications of pursuing that agenda when clearly you do not have the context that's even going to allow for that. And this is, in some respects, really the meta story of the Obama administration's failure, is that at no juncture during his presidency, it seems to me, has the administration been aware of the context and what that context calls for. They have always, and you saw this with their campaigns, and it was it's one of those things where your strengths in one area tend to be problematic in another. The one thing about the Obama campaign, particularly in 08, but I would also argue in 2012, was that they picked a point in the horizon and they never stopped aiming for that point. And in a campaign, that is crucial, I think, because you are dictating the terms. However, in the context of him entering into the presidency at a time where the public was ready, and I would argue the Republicans were incapable of mounting a real defense against some genuine populist changes, they never took their eye off of what their prize was, which was that entitlement reform. And as such, we are suffering because of their rigidity in, never mind the fact that we disagree with what that point on the horizon should be. We're suffering because of that rigidity, because they are pursuing an agenda that they cannot get to. And the fallout is things like empowering the Republicans on all sorts of crisis points that they're able to create, empowering the Republicans so much so that we now have these across the board cuts to domestic services, and empowering the Republicans to give them the ability to continue to hamper some type of genuine economic recovery that's going to bring jobs. And they refuse to give up that point on the horizon and take a different tact. And it's an obliviousness that I think is to the context in which they're operating, which I think is really ultimately that which is so dangerous for the country.
I mean, yeah, I wish
I mean,
could
I don't
disagree
mean to,
with
to monologue
basically anything you just said, but I can't. I mean, that's all true. They set up this point and they've remained obsessed with it. Doesn't matter what changes and what happens. And you can have people point out the facts sort of as many times as you want. You can have people point out the facts of, you know, that these programs are not in crisis, that the first time that they wouldn't even be able to pay out 100% is 30 years away or so, that simple changes, you want to reform it, fine. Reform how, the cap and the payroll tax. There are reformers you can do that would take care of all of this. You could go and do something crazy like every other industrialized country does and have, HHS bulk negotiate right. for prescription drugs. And so that people don't lose any benefits. The cost that's lowered is the cost to government because we're being ripped off. And we're being ripped off because a special interest holds sway. You could do that. You know, and yet that's not what we're going to do. We need to do some sort of other fix that's just not necessary.
Well, and this is a reflection. I mean, Jonathan Alter has a piece out today, not coincidentally, in my estimation, because I still think that this they have not
taken. Is the title of that piece "What I Need to Say About President Obama to Get My Next Book Contract Writing About Him"?
The interesting thing is that he really, and I really want to have him on the program to talk about this because I don't know who is who he's writing this to. It's "Why Democrats Must Get Smart on Entitlements" is the way he's entitled it, and he is, I guess, lamenting the fact that a majority of U.S. House Democrats signed a letter to urge President Obama to oppose any benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other entitlements. That's the last thing we need. Now, contemplate this for a moment. If John Boehner and his caucus would be willing to accept the deal that Jonathan Alter has put out here, that outlines here, entitlements for tax increases, this would already be a done deal. I mean, this would have been a done deal. President Obama has put this on the table on multiple occasions. He reiterated it today. But yet, Alter is attacking Democrats as if the majority of Democrats in the House could even stop that deal if they wanted to. But he is attacking Democrats for their ideological stance. This is an ideological war that is being waged on the majority of Americans and hopefully, one might think, and maybe not even, the majority of Democratic elected representatives. There is a deep-seated desire to cut entitlements, regardless of what the context is and regardless of how impossible it is would even be to do it at this point, because Republicans are just so adamant about not raising taxes. And he right. goes on and on in this piece to make this case as to why we should accept these cuts now to entitlements that he say are in jeopardy in the future. I mean, the whole argument is, of course, that if you don't cut these entitlements, you're going to have to cut domestic discretionary spending. But the pursuit of cutting those entitlements has brought us this very situation where we have these cuts in discretionary domestic spending. It's just fascinating to watch this, how relentless these people are in cutting these benefits. And we know that 401ks have been a complete failure in providing for Social Security. We know that the number one driver of these entitlement costs when you talk about Medicare and Medicaid is a function of health care itself, not the mechanism which to pay for it. But there's no addressing of those issues. It's fascinating. It's fascinating and depressing.
Yeah, well, both. I mean, because there's all sorts of issues we need to be dealing with. And it just, it's sort of this whole thing, this whole dance over the deficit, you know, as opposed to jobs and everything. It just reminds us again, as if we need any reminding, but just that Washington's completely dysfunctional, and the things they decide to create and call real problems and big problems are not problems, you know, are not the things that we need to be doing. And that's the most generous way of putting it. The more, you know, whether we're talking about the war in Iraq or we're talking about the debt obsession, in both of them, you know, that's a generous way to put it. A non-generous way to put it would be that people starve and in other cases get killed because of the things people decide to prioritize in Washington that are stupid and counterproductive and frankly are evil.
Now,
I want to
touch on the gun stuff because there's a couple important stories that have happened this week in terms of gun control. But before we get there, let's just take a moment
change gears a little bit and talk about the Voting Rights Act, which by all accounts...
We can't insult Bob Woodward again?
Well, I mean, if there's a way you can rope it, or if you can bring it back in, I'm certainly open to it.
I'm sure I'll find ways to insult him along the way.
We are really seeing the culmination of a 30-some-odd year, probably 40, but really a 30-some-odd year agenda by the right wing in this country to roll back the Voting Rights Act. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, had the Voting Rights Act in his sights as a lawyer in the Reagan administration 30 years ago, and now he's in a position to start that rollback by starting with Section 5, which is the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. And it's just it really is amazing to watch Scalia get up there and make the case. His case is far more naked, that the idea that we would somehow protect the power of African-American voting rights and the power of other minority, non-English speaking, perhaps, people's voting rights as an ongoing perpetuation of a racial entitlement.
Using that term is so unbelievable, a racial entitlement to be able to vote. You know, it just reminds me of his decision in Lawrence versus Texas. You know, oh, there's no protection for people's behavior. The state should be able to basically ban homosexuals from engaging in, you know, what, kissing each other, doing anything. As far as he's got such a distorted 17th century, I mean, you know, his view on guns being an individual right. Every historian who has a clue would tell him he has no idea what he's talking about on Citizens United and campaign finance law. I mean, this guy basically, and he always says the same thing, you know. I remember on the health care law, you know, he's like, well, what about the Cornhusker kickback with Ben Nelson?
Right.
And I was like, what are you talking – are you Rush Limbaugh?
Yeah.
Or are you a judge on the highest court? Do you deal in law or are you making a political statement? It doesn't matter how the bill got passed. That's, by the way, sir, that's none of your freaking business. What matters is whether it's constitutional or not. All right. It doesn't matter who is making deals in back rooms, which people do. I mean, this guy is on the highest court in the land is really such a cruel joke because he's Rush Limbaugh in a robe. That's all he is. And the racial entitlements part of it, I mean, that he would – I mean, then Alito, I think, joined in with him. Like, well, why should it only apply to these places? Aren't we discriminating against them? Shouldn't it be everywhere else? I got two answers to you. It applies to them because they had a history of unbelievable discrimination. And, yes, why don't we extend it everywhere else?
Yes.
Why don't we stop the Republicans in Hamilton County here in Ohio from trying to stop people from voting? Why don't we stop Scott Walker and his buddies in Wisconsin from doing it? Why don't we extend it to Pennsylvania where they pass this ridiculous ID law? I think it's a great idea, Justice Alito. Let's make it every state.
Well, this
make
is
sure
also,
we really prevent this.
This gets into their relationship with lawmakers because Scalia made a big issue of like who could possibly vote. The fact that you've actually seen more majorities and almost a unanimity in reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act became evidence to Scalia that we no longer need this because there's no resistance to it. And it's just that in some way lawmakers are being bullied by public perception into voting for this. And if
right,
that
because
is,
it sounds good, it's you know, who would go against that?
That's
none of your freaking business, pal.
It's stunning. It's stunning. And if you want to throw it back to the legislature and make it and say that you really do need to make this conform to some notion, then they should be obligated to throw it back to the Senate and the House and say, you've got 2 years, and this is something that we see judges do, you've got 2 years, legislature, to make this comport to a better constitutional framework, which would be either scrap the whole thing or impose this preclearance across the country. And that would be an interesting dynamic. They know, of course, at that point, they still would have to, that I believe that you still would see some type of reauthorization, or that it would put, the Republican Party in some type of disadvantage.
advantage electorally.
But it doesn't really matter, because as we know, Scalia's just a hack and a liar. Right. And so, you know, if that were his real interest, then yeah, he would do that and say, well, let's see the whole, let's see if you can apply it to the whole country. But if he really, if in the end, he, you know, his whole view of things were more that way, well, then maybe Bush v. Gore gets figured out a little differently, doesn't it? Right, yeah. but the reason why is Scalia, to his eternal shame, although he's got so much eternal shame, I don't know where the list begins and ends. You know, it was more important that Bush's rights be protected, as he said in that decision, that of course would never extend anywhere else, his equal rights, than the rights of everybody who actually was, you know, taking the time to vote.
Right.
And so, I mean, this is transparent, as it always is transparent with him. You know, people have to give him the benefit of the doubt because he gets the benefit of wearing a robe. Otherwise, this guy, again, would just be a right-wing talk radio host you would laugh at, because there's no logic in any of his decisions. It's certainly not based on historical precedent. I mean, again, this is so utterly ridiculous, as if we need to be reminded, you know, we'll need more details to find out exactly what happened. But the first openly gay African-American who was running for mayor in a city in Mississippi was just murdered.
Yep.
And they're quite suspicious right now. It's because, guess what? He's openly gay and African-American. So obviously none of that stuff ever happens anymore, right?
Right.
I mean, there's complete racial equality. You don't hear a different, you know, backbench Republican in a different state legislature around the country saying every day about how abortion's aimed at eliminating black babies and, you know, things like that. We never hear any of that stuff. We don't have, you know, Dove, whatever the hell his name is, up there in your neck of the woods, Hivekind or whatever, putting on blackface for Purim, right? I mean, there's definitely no racial issues.
No.
We're all one big happy family now in America. Let's just get rid of it.
It's stunning. All right, but now we just have a little bit of time left, so I want to just again make another pivot. There were a couple of very important.
The fact that Bob Woodward's unbelievably stupid.
That's a great segue. We just keep going back to that. There were three things that struck me this week in terms of gun control. One was the Tenth Circuit, United States Court of Appeals, found that the Heller opinion of 2010 essentially allows for concealed carry laws, essentially prohibitions on concealed carry laws, which was an interesting step for this court to take, because we're now seeing sort of like the how Heller is being parsed by lower courts.
And even in Scalia's tortured logic, and finding that it was an individual right, which would have been laughed out of courts 30 years ago or less, he did say that, which is different areas of the country have legislated over the years, have ruled about concealed carry differently, and showing that at least he's read a few history books, because in the 19th century, a variety of states, you know, from Wyoming, I mean, states you wouldn't imagine this in, to Kentucky and Ohio and others, banned concealed carry, because they you know, even Texas even did. Texas.
Wasn't it Dodge? You come into Dodge, you got to leave your guns at the, you know, at the edge of the town or whatever it was?
Right. They banned it in the city there, but I'm saying in addition to that, whole states did, because there was one famous, I'm trying to remember if he was a governor or whatever, of Texas said, the only purpose of a concealed gun is to kill, which is, of course, mostly true. I mean, I guess there are some people that now that do because everyone else has them. So there are people that generally feel they're protecting themselves, although if they were to look at any statistics or anything, they'd realize they're not. But that is – in any case, I'll let you continue because I know we got to go.
Well,
but, yeah, that was the correct reading.
The other one was, of course, we had some hearings in the Senate. And just because, I mean, I don't know how relevant this is, but just because it just sounds so great, let's hear Lindsey Graham get smacked down by a chief of police. This police officer
of Milwaukee. He should run for office, be a new rock star. He just destroyed him.
He used to be in Springfield, Mass. Actually.
Oh, he was from Springfield, Mass.
I think he's in Milwaukee now, but he's
The dregs of Massachusetts, with all due respect, Mike.
That guy rocks.
And all right, so let's hear this exchange with Lindsey Graham and this police officer.
The law obviously is not seeing that as important. If it's such an important issue, why aren't we prosecuting people who fail a background check? And there are 15 questions there. They're not hard to understand if you're filling out the form. So I'm a bit frustrated that we say one thing, how important it is, but in the real world, we absolutely do nothing to enforce the laws on the books. Now, let's talk.
I mean, you know, just for the record, from my point of view, Senator, the purpose
how
of the background check.
How many cases have you made? How many cases?
It doesn't matter. It's a paper thing.
Well,
I want to stop 76. I want to finish the answer.
Well, no,
I want to stop 76,000 people from buying guns illegally. That's what a background check does. If you think we're going to do paperwork prosecutions, you're wrong.
How many?
All right.
How many cases?
Senator, if you would withhold just for a moment.
Yeah.
Please.
That's fine.
No expressions one way or another, and let's keep this civil.
Right.
Senator Graham and I just got recognized for civility, so I know he'll keep it civil.
But being civil and being firm in your convictions are not inconsistent, are they? I admire what you do. I think every cop deserves everything
that
comes their way.
All right, we don't need to hear
any
more of his groveling at that point now that he's been punished. Here is Lindsey Graham trying to make the case that the police officers should be essentially tracking down people who fail a background check. Well, that's the whole point of a background check, is just to make sure they don't get a gun.
I mean, where to start, where to finish here? First of all, in Lindsey Graham's defense, he hasn't gone rug shopping in Iraq for a while.
Right.
And he got some of those great 3-for-1 deals that he bragged about, you know, and when it was all safe over there, when all the security went in there. So I understand. He relaxes by rug shopping. And it's been tough. I mean, he's such a patently ridiculous character. I'll say it quickly. I can't wait. I love it. I mean, this guy obviously hasn't taken the time to look at what happened to Dick Lugar and other people that were more conservative on other issues than him. Like, if he thinks he's preventing himself from a teabagger from running from his right and slamming him as if that will ever happen, I just can't wait till he gets his ass handed to him in 2014 from the right. But that's neither here nor there. In terms of what he was saying, I mean, again, that's what the police chief, it's so refreshing, because often these guys sit there and you have these you know, bullies who literally are just putting on a show for the cameras, who think they can just sit there and say whatever they want, and they normally get away with it. And the point he was making, as you just said, Sam, is 70,000 people are stopped from buying guns,
right,
who are criminals or are mentally ill. That's the point of the system. In addition to that, his 44 number is a joke and way off. That 44 number, I think, is, if I'm remembering correctly, was just from like one place. I think it was just from the city of Chicago, and they've taken that and they've turned it into that's the national number. It's not. It's a much higher number who actually were prosecuted afterwards. And his general point that more of them should be prosecuted, I would agree with. But that doesn't mean that these guys weren't doing the first.
Right. We have our police departments make these type of decisions all the time. What is going to be the biggest threat? Where is our biggest bang for buck in terms of enforcement? I mean, that's the way they do it.
Guess who's cutting their resources?
Right.
Lindsey Graham is. So
right.
he can allow tax cuts for his rich friends who finance his campaign. If they would do what were required in this country and give the police departments the budgets, first responders or the budgets they ask for, then maybe they could follow up on some of the stuff that Lindsey Graham cares about. And frankly, I think would be good too, which is to prosecute people who try to buy guns illegally. But with that said, the most important thing that a gun check does is it stops the person from getting the gun.
Right.
And as the police chief made, the point he made in Milwaukee alone, they made 2,000 of those cases where they prosecuted people, based upon that. So that's what's important for using guns illegally or getting them illegally. And that is what we're trying to stop here. That is what a background check will do. This is an NRA talking point. It's not even true. And that Lindsey Graham would do that. I mean, it's just so nice to see somebody stand up to him as he sort of prostrates himself before the right to try to somehow stop the inevitable challenge that's coming his way in 2014.
Yeah, and then the next part, of course, your point is well taken, because Graham then goes on to say that budgets will be cut, so people may need to protect themselves at that point. So, all right, but
budgets will be cut. I love how the agency is taken away there. Who will be cutting those budgets?
Right, exactly. Well, of course, Bob Woodward says that it was President Obama. Now,
Bob, I think it's Bob Woodward and Gene Sperling's fault myself.
But, all right, we got 2 minutes left. There was one other story this week that involved Chicago, or I should say, Jesse Jackson.
Bob Woodward's from Chicago.
Well,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay, I'm done with that joke.
You had Robin Kelly win the seat in a special election. Jesse Jackson Jr. resigned because of, well, criminal activity, essentially, and other issues that he had. But so this was a solidly blue district. So it really was about the Democratic primary. With the full disclosure that you work for Mayors Against Gun Violence, not the organization that was involved in that race, but obviously a PAC that was...
Mayor Bloomberg is one of the two co-chairs of Mayors Against Legal Guns. Yes, Mayor Menino of Boston also, right. and it's Mayor Bloomberg's super PAC, the Independence PAC, that put $2.2 million in there, yes.
Right, okay, so just this changed the outcome of that race. And it was pivoted on the other Democrat in this race who could have won because it was a wide open field. You only needed about 33% to win at that point. That other candidate, Haverly, I think it was, Halverson, Debbie Halverson,
yes.
She had an A rating from the NRA, and that ended up basically being a tie around her neck that made it impossible for her to win.
Right, and let's explain why this is important, because people say, oh, you know, vast majority Democratic district, particularly a lot of it's African-American, and so...
We just got 1 minute.
Here's the big deal. Debbie Halverson had run against Jesse Jackson Jr. and lost in the primary in 2010. She came into this thing, or 2012, she came into this thing with a huge lead. She's a former congresswoman. She has higher name recognition. She had actually been endorsed in both of her races, the one she won and the one in 2008, the one she lost in 2010, by the NRA. Okay, over her Republican opponent. So she's one of those Democrats that's that crazy.
Yeah.
All right, and there are some rural aspects to this reconfigured district. And in the end, sure, he would be at a disadvantage in terms of voters, but the NRA claims they didn't do anything in there. Yes, they did. They sent out mailers at the end. And why did they not do anything else? Because they knew they would lose. That's why they didn't do anything else. In the end, not just Mayor Bloomberg's super PAC, but a group of progressive organizations and groups from Daily Coast to Credo Mobile,
yep.
To who am I thinking of? DFA, I think the PCCC and others who I know folks you have on this show, made this race a priority, and as importantly to someone like me, made the gun issue a priority and has realized, as I've been yelling on your show for way too long and have annoyed probably almost everyone, even your last listener, if I scared them away on it, that this was an issue that would be a winner, that this is an issue that if you look at the changing demographics, the way gay marriage has become a winner just in 8 or 10 years now, and the way standing up for contraception and abortion rights has become a winner, standing up for immigration reform has become a winner. In addition to all of that, standing up for passing gun safety has become a winner. And there will be exceptions, parts of Alabama,
right.
Or Utah, no. But in most swing states, I mean, when polls come out that show in Kentucky that 65% of voters post Newtown favor registration of guns and almost 80% favor closing the gun show loophole, things have changed.
It's going to be a fascinating dynamic. In the coming days, I hope to have somebody on from Credo to talk about this, too, because I think the implications of this, very often, not always, but an A rating from the NRA comes with a whole other bucket full of positions, essentially, that are going to have implications for...
I'll tell you in 2 seconds the interesting race to watch on this, if you have it.
Yes.
You have 2 more seconds?
Go.
The interesting race to watch will be Susan Collins up in Maine.
Okay.
Because it's a Democratic state. She's going to be vulnerable, but she's worried about being challenged from the Tea Party right. We'll see, because if she does do that, if she moves to her right to try to head stuff off and doesn't support reasonable gun control measures, you're going to see that that's going to be an issue that she's going to have her butt kicked with up there.
Mark,
it's going to be interesting.
Cliff Schechter's words, ladies and gentlemen. Cliff, thank you so much. Got to run, but really appreciate it, as always.
I appreciate it too, Sam. Thanks for having me on, buddy.
Talk to you soon. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Richard Kind, and he'll give me a movie suggestion.
Oh,
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to welcome back to this program what I am calling a near Academy Award winning associate.
No, I am an Academy Award winning associate.
Richard Kind, you were, first off, I want to know why you were not on the dais when Argo won an Academy Award.
I was not invited to the party.
Oh, really?
That is the reason why. I mean, you know, people really ask that. First of all, I'm way down on the call list. Secondly, it doesn't matter. If you are not nominated, you don't get to the party. You don't get to go. The only reason Bryan Cranston was there was maybe he paid $10,000 for the ticket. Maybe Warner Brothers said, you know what, you're famous. You're going to be doing more of our movies. We'll take you along. But if you're not there, you're not there.
Well, I got to say that I think many people would agree that had Ben Affleck expanded your character in this piece, he probably would have been had a better shot at Best Director. I mean, let's be honest.
I didn't know where it was going to go, but I knew that was the route you were taking.
Well, of course. I mean, everybody walking out of the theater, not that I watched it in a theater, but sitting in my my room watching it on DVD, because I am a member of SAG, I previewed the movie.
You gripped the couch's armrest with excitement.
I was like, wait a second. Both myself and my wife just turned to each other and said, we want to follow that character more. You played the casting director in the, right? Is that what, or like an agent, essentially? I mean, you were a Hollywood guy.
The producer. I had the movie. Some people think it's the writer of the movie, but it's the producer of the movie Argo.
Right.
That's what it was.
That's where the meat of the story is. Yes, there's the intrigue about being in Iran and whatnot, but I want to know how you're putting that movie together.
It was a very nice little role. I was happy to do it. That's what it was. A very nice little role.
Yeah, no, it was great. And so did you go out? You didn't even get to go to the Oscars, but you went to the Oscar party, surely.
You know what? Two of my best friends, one's very well known and one is not as well known, but is a great guy and now a great Academy Award winning producer, produced the movie. My friend Grant Heslop, who was an actor, I knew him when he was an actor, and we're best friends, and we go, you know, I know his whole family, everything like that. Grant is now George Clooney's producing partner, and they run the company Smokehouse Films, and, you know, he produced the film.
Now, wait great. A second. Now,
and 15 years ago, that guy was literally cutting people's audition tapes, trying to make a living as an actor. And, you know, I had a little studio thing. You know, it was great. This story is wonderful. It's a really, really great story.
That's basically your way of saying that there's still an opportunity for me.
That is, and for the world.
Now, Grant is the guy who got up there, and I thought he had a great joke. Nobody seemed to get it, but he said something to the effect of, like, I know you're sitting here going, like, you know, how is it that there's these...
The three of the greatest looking producers. Yeah, the sexiest. Is that it?
Yeah. I thought that was a great joke, but the audience didn't seem to pick up on it.
Okay. After four and a half hours, what are you going to do?
Was he upset about that? Give us a little insight.
No. He gave a great speech.
I know.
Your perception, Sam, you're a little more savvy by all of this than all of this. Yeah, he won the Academy Award. Honest to God, there's nothing that can upset you when you win an Academy Award.
I don't know. I just sort of think, like, I think there is a quality of people, particularly actors, where, you know, if there's one person not laughing and you tell a joke, it's always that one person you focus on, right? So, yeah, he walks off with the Oscar. But
at that point, as I asked him, I said, what was it like? And he just goes, it was a surreal moment. You don't even realize you're there. You just don't know it. I mean, just try and put yourself in his place. There's 3,000 people looking at you. You can't believe it. You have reached the pinnacle of artistic or cinema success. in anywhere, the pinnacle. And you're holding that symbol of that in your hand, and will have it for the rest of your life. What? Who's listening or counting or anything that he could remember to open his mouth is something. I can't even think of what must go through somebody's mind. You don't go, gee, I wish they laughed at that. Your heart is pounding.
And
you're sitting at home going, why aren't they laughing at this? He's going, what the hell am I doing here? Whose dream life is this?
And I got to ask you, were you saying, as you were watching, where were you watching this? I imagine that you were at a chic Hollywood party.
I was George and Grant, the production company, threw a party at a wonderful restaurant called Craig's on Melrose. It's a great restaurant. If you're in L.A., I encourage you to – and Craig just had twins 2 weeks ago. It's a great guy. And so they rented out the restaurant because we all know Craig. And so I was watching actually with a bigger star, a couple of bigger stars in the cast, Tate Donovan and Chris Denham. I can't remember the blonde's name, but she's so pretty. She played one of the hostages, another. And, that's where we were. We were watching it.
That's like Seth MacFarlane impersonation
there. A lot
of
very close friends at George and Grant's were together, and the restaurant only had about 30 people in it. I mean, later on that night, it must have had 200, but we were just, quietly watching, and we screamed when our friends, it's Hollywood, but for us, it's why we maintain our friendships, and we, that's who it was. It was just a...
Now, Richard, be honest with me. Was there just a little bit of that, like, hey, how come I'm not up there? Come on, be honest with me.
I hope someday I get invited to the party, and I often say, well, why don't I become a producer? Why shouldn't I work at George's company? And then I realized, because I would stink at it. I can't even keep my household going. How in the world am I going to take a multi-million dollar movie and try and organize that?
And frankly, it would be too much of a loss. We need you. We need you acting. It would be.
And that's one other reason. It's because I give to the world. Exactly. This is the dumbest question I've ever heard. No, I did say, I jokingly say, I would crawl through glass to get an Academy Award. That's what every actor, wants to do. They dream about it. And not necessarily that much anymore. Of course, I dream about it. But when you're a kid, you dream about it. So, I mean, I can harken back to that time where that was the be-all and end-all. Now I love to work. I like doing good work. But, to ask anybody, any actor, they wouldn't want to win an Academy Award. Oh, my God. Yeah, but on the flip side of that is ask any actor who wouldn't want the opportunity to give a performance that is worthy of an Academy Award and do that kind of work. That's another way of looking at it. And I think that I'm old enough to know, oh, my gosh, wouldn't it be great to have a great role like that and be able to perform it?
You know, I got to say, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm holding in my hand the 2012 Podcast Award for Politics and News that
you
I'm
know
holding.
Exactly where from I speak.
I am holding it in my hand as we speak. And I was unable to attend the ceremonies in Las Vegas that were hosted by Leo Laporte. I'm sure you know the host
Who
of the
is it? Who?
Leo Laporte. And you're joking now, of course, that you don't know who he is, but he is the award-winning host of Tech and Week, I think it is, podcast. And I sent my producer Matt, and I watched it on the stream, and just the sheer excitement that I had when the Majority Report was named as the 2012 best podcast in politics and news. So I certainly know exactly what your friends felt. I will say this.
I do want to ask honestly, why didn't you go?
Why didn't I go to Vegas? Because, my wife is pregnant and, we were, how it is with pregnant wives. it's very much about nesting, and there's got to, you know, there's a lot of purging. You'd have to bring.
What was the time between when the awards were and her due date?
Well, a couple months.
No, I don't think that's a very good excuse. Did you know you were going to win?
You know what? Matt was convinced that we were going to win because they flew us out there. They flew Matt out there. So he's right. Like, they wouldn't have done that.
So that's something else. You're talking about a day and a half because you gained time. So you could have left that night, the night before, or even that day, the day of the awards. My guess is they were held at night, flown back the next day early. You're talking about a day and a half. Your wife could have survived without you. I know your wife. She is certainly a woman of the world with a foundation of strength who could certainly make her own breakfast the next day, no matter how uncomfortable she was, in order to take care of your other child.
Well,
I think she could have handled herself. And were you excited that you were going to win?
Was I excited that I was going to win? I mean, you know. Uh-huh. It's of course, it's everything that everybody dreams of as a kid.
You don't dream of it as a kid, but now it's what you're doing.
Yeah,
isn't it nice to know that not just money, but actual, that you're not just rewarded with money, but actually people who enjoy what you do.
It's almost phrase that in lieu of money. Of course. Of course. I definitely appreciate it, which I mean, I watched the live stream. I was very excited. And I texted Matt as soon as he went up there. But so, yes. And if had we had this conversation 3 months ago, I would have gone.
Sure. Absolutely. They're giving you an award. They're telling you you're successful at what you're doing.
Yeah, I guess I have always a natural and sort of it's in my DNA to be suspicious of such things, frankly. I mean, you know.
It's your job to be cynical. It's also your job to be cynical.
Yes, I think so. Like, I have to say that I didn't watch all of the Academy Awards this time, but I watched almost 60% of it, and it is the most of any Academy Awards I've ever watched in my entire life. When I was an actor, I would go to the parties, but it was basically, you know, that it was mostly in New York, your attorney would throw a party or something like that, your entertainment lawyer, and it was almost exclusively to pick up girls. I wouldn't even watch the.
Well, I live my life for that. That
right.
is what I live. That's my raison d'être.
Right.
But when I was a kid,
thrown around the French must help.
I would dress up. I would put on a coat and tie and watch the Oscars and not let any of my family into our living room, where our den where we watched. I would watch it alone. Now all I watch was.
Do you have?
Watch,
is there a photograph of that? Because I would love to see.
It looks just like my bar mitzvah picture, except my family isn't around. And then this year, I always watch the first 20 minutes because I want to hear the jokes and you see the numbers, and then I stop watching it. I don't watch it. I didn't watch any of the Academy Awards except for. When they announced for Argo. I saw it at one party. I was at this party in L.A., and the reason why I love going to the party is there's a lot of old, old stars. I mean, you could call it the mausoleum. It's just old, old stars. And every once in a while, you get a star who you really want to talk to and you want to sort of dig into what it was like. I got to talk to Kevin McCarthy one year for about 2 hours. This year, you know who I met?
Who?
This year I talked to Bernie Coppell for a little while. Remember Bernie Coppell?
Was he a producer? Who is he?
He was on Love Boat. He was most. I didn't watch
Love
Boat.
Oh, right. He was Dog.
I would talk to him. I talked to him about Get Smart, and he was talking about his early days with Jack Benny. So it's a great party, and I see a lot of old friends who I used to know when I lived in L.A. So I love that party. I left that party at around 7:15, 7:30, and then I went to this other party at Craig's and saw all my friends and just was talking to my friends. And so I don't watch the awards either anymore, which is really – actually, I find very sad. I find it really sad. It has nothing to do with, oh, it's so boring. I actually taped it. and I have it at home, and I'm going to probably watch it all.
Wow.
But I don't watch it anymore.
Now I will say this.
I really do think that's sad.
Why is that sad?
Because I used to be all excited about the glamour. Not the glamour, about the history. I
got to say that the as far as I could tell, those Academy Awards could have been shot in 1985. It seemed like every number they did was sort of some type of weird throwback. Seth MacFarlane, the host, seemed to be like talking in a different age, like they were trying to make it like the Brat Pack, you know, where women were dames. Or, you know, they had nice gams.
Yes.
I thought he was going to say it.
But I happen to have loved Seth MacFarlane on the show. And I was at something the other night at a a seminar, a roundtable thing. And the women there...
A roundtable for what? Wait a second. What does that mean? You're at an Oscar roundtable?
At for a school.
Oh, okay.
For school. I went to something about... resilience for girls, believe it or not.
Okay.
How you know, when you're young and you know, I've got an 11-year-old and we're, you know, she's getting a little bit older. So we're at this table and one of the women brought up the song that Seth MacFarlane sang and said how awful it was, what a slap in the face to women, to all these great actresses, that the media just shows girls and women, shows women as objects, and but she's right. And yet I thought it was hilarious. I simply thought it was so funny, and I understand, and she's right, and I'm not a victim of such things as women have to be nowadays by sexualizing them or what's the word I wanted to use, but as mere objects, you know, portraying them as mere objects rather than as people, as three-dimensional people. And I'm not a victim of that kind of prejudice. Or so it was, I just looked at it and laughed, you know. Yeah. I understand this woman. And on the other hand, I want to say, lighten up, lady. There were a lot of women to get augmentation. So that they can show off their bosoms in a certain way.
I like how you're saying that. Like when you're retelling the idea that you were going to say lighten up, you almost went into like a almost like an Andrew Dice Clay type of lighten up, lady.
It might be interpreted as an Andrew Dice Clay, but I hope I don't go that base.
No.
I'm going a little baser than I'd like to be, but I do want to say, lighten up. I thought did you hear about the Onion Twitter?
Yes. The Onion had
and
a...
I'm sorry. I guffawed, and I'm going to tell you something right now. Shame on the Onion for apologizing. Shame on that. Maybe shame on the producers of the Oscars to let a song like that go on the air. But I thought it was funny. But what the Onion did was simply hilarious. There is nothing that was offensive about that except for the use of the word. But nevertheless, the use of the word made it that much funnier.
You know, I got to be honest. I know the vague outlines of it. What did the actual tweet say? I know that they used the word "see you next Tuesday," as we say it around here, for obvious reasons.
Give me the young actress's name from Children of the Southern Beast.
I can't remember her name, but let's call her young actress.
Okay, let's call it Mary Smith.
Okay.
Let's call it. It's something like something Wallace. I know it is, but I can't remember it. Okay, and they go. They said, "Is it just me, or is Mary Smith a see you next Tuesday?" Now that it was, or is. Yes, I think that's what it was. Now, that to me is hilarious. The girl's not even known. We've not seen interviews. She's a dear little child. It's the furthest thing. It's the furthest thing from
right.
it.
Right.
Oh, it was just, it was hilarious. It was so out of the blue, and it was funny. And I just think that the Onion should not have apologized. Because they rather on the flip side, on the other side of the coin, they should have been congratulated
Wow.
for being so inoffensive.
Wow.
The only offensive part of that thing is the use of the word. But the use of the word made it that much funnier. There's no other word.
Well, I think we've broken some news.
What?
We got our exclusive for the TMZ.
It's what I believe. Right. I truly do believe it. I'm so sorry that the Onion... look, I might get in trouble. I might get in as much trouble as the Onion did. Look, this is going out there. But that is something, yes, lighten up. Lighten up. That is simply taking a very, very innocent young thing and
I think the further you go, the more chances are you're going to have to apologize for this.
I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I agree.
Hold on, wait a second. Michael, one of my producers, wants to ask you a question.
Hey there. I have a question for you. I disagree with you a little bit about the Onion joke, but I see what you're saying. I actually thought Seth MacFarlane's joke about her was a lot more questionable. You remember that joke?
Which joke?
The joke where he said that she's 9, so that means in like 15 years she'll be too old for George Clooney. Do you remember
that
joke?
That's a funny joke.
It's a funny joke, but she was sitting right there. Yeah. She's a 9-year-old kid. Yeah.
Well, I don't think kids should be allowed to go.
You don't do it in front of her.
Right.
That's the first thing. And it's an easy joke. It's an easier joke. What the Onion did was so smart. It went to the edge. You would never think in the world to call a little thing like that what they did. It's out of the realm of possibility. So that only a great comic mind would think, because she's the furthest thing from it.
I'm starting to now. I'm starting to think that you wrote the joke.
That I what?
I'm starting to think that it was a retweet of yours.
No, I'm not smart enough to make a joke like that. That's why the Onion is so funny.
Richard,
the Onion is funnier than anything I could ever come up with.
Coming out strong, pro Onion use of that joke. Well, all right, mark your calendars, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Well, Richard, we don't have too much time. I know you're in the middle of you're rehearsing for something. Is that right? Can you talk about it?
I was, but we're broken for lunch.
And
but yes, no. Wait, you bring it up. I'm gonna.
Well, please do. I mean, come on.
For those of you who agree with my opinion and therefore may like me, come see a show called The Big Knife. It's at the American Airlines Theater. It's a roundabout production. Very prestigious theater company here in New York. It's going to be on Broadway. Bobby Cannavale is in. The cast is spectacular.
Wow.
Bobby Cannavale, Reg Rogers, Chip Zion, Joey Slotnick. It's directed by Doug Hughes. Brilliant man. Brilliant director. Brilliant man. And it's heavy. If you
when does it open? And who are they going to have to replace you with after this whole thing about the Onion tweet gets out there?
Yeah. We start previews March 22nd, we open April 19th. And it's a very limited run because probably Bobby has a movie to do.
Well,
but
I'm sure you do,
he's
too.
Great in the show. I have a movie to watch.
Well, come on.
I don't necessarily have a movie to do.
Movie to watch is the perfect segue. What is the movie? It's a movie to watch is the perfect segue into you telling me what movie I should watch. As you know, I can't leave the house for an extended period of time. My wife could go into labor at any moment. Therefore, I need to watch any movie that I'm going to watch on streaming. What should I watch?
Okay, are you talking about a modern movie or what?
Whatever movie you think I should watch.
That's out now or a movie you can rent?
A movie that I can rent.
Have you ever seen Witness for the Prosecution?
Is this the one? No, I don't know if I have seen that.
It is directed by Billy Wilder with Charles Laughton, Tyrone Power, and Marlena Dietrich.
Witness for the Prosecution. Why should I watch that?
Witness for the Prosecution. Why?
Yeah.
Because it's really, really good. It's really good. I got another movie you should watch. Now, Witness for the Prosecution is one of my favorite movies to watch. It's my unknown favorite movie. Like, okay. It's just so much fun to watch. It's so good. It's so, so good. But, and I don't go out to the movies I don't see much because I've got a child. I've got three children.
Right.
So I haven't seen Lincoln yet. I haven't seen Amore. I haven't seen these movies. So, but I did see a movie. I was in L.A. and watched a movie with a friend and his wife, called Headhunters. Have you heard about it?
No.
It's a Danish movie. I wouldn't necessarily, I don't mind foreign films, but I wouldn't necessarily do this. This is such a good thriller. Ooh, it's really, really good. It's called Headhunters, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. You'll say, who directed it? Who starred in it? All I know are there are umlauts. That's all I know.
Umlauts. All right. Well, that's. I think we can just search on Netflix for umlauts, and it'll come up.
I think we watched it on his Apple TV.
Uh-huh.
But so I don't know whether you can get it on Netflix.
Well, that's fine, because I have Apple TV.
It is on Netflix.
And it's on Netflix. Bingo.
I can't recommend it highly enough. It's really good. You'll call me. You'll thank me. It's a good movie. It's really, really good.
Well, Richard, thank you for the recommendation. Thank you for
your... Thank you for ruining my career with my little endorsement of The Onion Joke.
I think the upside is you've just locked in best news and political podcast for me for 2013. Breaking stories like this.
I will be glad to find the vocabulary that will support why this was so good and why it was actually inoffensive, if you don't mind the C word.
Tell it to TMZ,
totally,
buddy.
Inoffensive.
Tell it to TMZ when they come knocking.
Huh. Well, TMZ is not my favorite either, but I'm sure I've just opened a new can of worms there, too.
Yeah, there you go. Boom. Slamming TMZ. Oh. I already get to see the headline for this. All right, Richard Kind, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to coming out and seeing Big Knife. Yes, we'll see you at Pickup or Drop-Off. All right, thanks, buddy.
I'll talk to you
Appreciate
later.
It.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
All right, folks, it's going to be a Freebie Friday. I got to go in about, you know what? I think we just got time for the songs and then maybe a couple IMs.
I just got to say, it's never the ones you expect.
No, I don't know what
that
means.
All the guests that we've had on for that segment, Richard Kind would probably be the last dude that I would think that would be like, hell yes, Seth MacFarlane.
Oh yeah, no, Richard Kind. He's a walking surprise. All right, folks. Here is the song of the week. It is actually Jimmy Reefer Cake's salute to one of our favorite callers, Jermo, done Schecter style.
Jermo at Jermo 5. He's my favorite caller. That ain't no jive. It's always nice to hear Jermo's voice talking to us live. Oh, Jermo at Jermo 5 on Twitter.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen.
Twitter.
It's going to be a Freebie Friday because I've got to go for one more gynecological visit, as it were. You know how this works, folks. I will take a couple of IMs. And remember, your support is what keeps the show alive. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% coupon code majority. And, if you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. All right, let's go through a couple IMs and then I get a run. Hey, Sammy, say hi to Richard Kind and ask him about the grand. Well, next time. Sorry, Bob Flav. Stuttgartkiss just paid for half a year's membership for G. Oh, thank you very much. G, of course, was the, let's get one of these. That is really very much appreciated. G, of course, was the emailer yesterday who I think it was yesterday or the day before who wrote in, said that they had to cut back because they're going to be facing a furlough. They're a government worker. And because of the sequester, very much appreciated. I really, really genuinely do appreciate it. We have to support each other and get a show. Can I get a shofar blast? You just got one. And greetings from Stuttgart. Auf Wiedersehen. Dankeschön. Bitte. Kevin 11, 7, 21.
Federal taxes are at 1950 levels. In 1955, average salary was $4,400. A week's worth of groceries cost $10. A car cost $4,000. Gas was 20 cents a gallon. Standard Oil made $120 million in profits in a year. Minimum wage was 75 cents an hour. Average price of a new home was $15,000. Of course, government has a deficit. We have a revenue problem. Maddow was on Stewart last night. She went to see the Supreme Court hearings, which are never broadcast. She made an amazing observation. Said Scheele would drop the bombs and then excitedly check the room for a reaction, trying to say the most outrageous things because it titillates him to get a rise out of people, the left. He's basically a blog troll. I think you might be right about that. Yuri Spahmed. You see, Bradley Manning tried to give the cables to the Washington Post and New York Times before he went to WikiLeaks. Indeed, I think this revelation dovetails nicely with Bob Woodward's recent blow-up. These days, the media is so distracted, skittish, and vain to take anything on of substance. Couldn't agree more. Sammy Kammer. Scalia seemed to be saying that the Supreme Court had to invalidate the Voting Rights Act in order to protect honest legislators who felt powerless to oppose it in face of political pressure. Of course, the same logic didn't apply to a Citizens United analysis. Great point. Great, great point. The senators are afraid of the people, but not of the corporations. Millions of dollars of laundered campaign contributions don't corrupt the legislative process in any way. Sam McCammer, that is a fantastic point, one which I hope to what's the polite word for steal? Appropriate. Appropriate. That is really well said. Jabbles 1001. Sam, I'll say it so you won't have to. Bob Woodward is a pussy. I'm reading that I am. Maxercise. Scalia doesn't mean to lie. He's just a dullard. And all ego, no shame. Just listen to him. If he were a judge, he'd be issued a wooden safety gavel. Hold on. Never mind. Bush and Chains. Can't do all nine, buddy. I'll do the last one. My own random rush. Obama's going to kill Bob Woodward with a death panel. Flush Rush, even the cabal of tapeworms at AIG is requesting for ads to be removed from Rush Limbaugh's show. Oh, that's exciting. 1001, Sam, Leo Laporte is on This Week in Tech, or TWIT. The I is lowercase, the abbreviation as in N. Sorry about that. I just need to correct someone on the radio, just like the time you pulled over your car and called into that radio program to tell that guy how he was wrong. Indeed. The goddess Olivia. I have to say I agree with Richard Kind about the onion joke. If they had said bitch instead of what they said, it would have been a non-issue. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Bryn Hild. I thought the Onion tweet was funny, too, but I think your guest totally missed the point of the joke. It was directed at the ugliness that is directed to female actresses by the media and their fans and their looks as people. Right now, it's somehow fashionable to hate Anne Hathaway, and she's called many vile names. I think you're right, and I think probably Richard picks up on that as well.
And what Matt says about Anne Hathaway in The Office is disturbing.
The final I am of the day, C. McDonald.
Sam, I'm a big Anne Hathaway fan, excuse you.
You didn't know Bernie Koppel was Siegfried from Get Smart? How young are you? Great show, man. All the best. No, indeed I did. I just didn't know his name was Bernie Koppel. It is scarce. We don't do that here, I think is what he used to say. All right, folks. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice was made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know? Takes you. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright.
shifted in and out of.